Hi, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, August 3rd, 1999. In the fireside room this evening is Ralph Milton. Today's session number is 99-2, and it's titled Holy Fools. Let's listen in.
All right. My name is Ralph Milton. I am a storyteller by profession, writer, and stuff like that. And I have a wonderful son-in-law who makes marvelous t-shirts. And that's where he's come from. They're all one of a kind.
Well, he can market that one here so well.
I know. I could have sold at least a dozen of those if I had had them here, but I don't. They're one of a kind. Okay, before you listen to anybody, you always should know a little bit about where they're coming from, and so that you can then take that into consideration in terms of how much you want to buy of their particular argument and how much you want to sort of set aside. You should know that most of the time when the weather is cooler and I'm wearing long pants, I'm also wearing suspenders. That's an important piece of information you need. Just need to move this back a little so I have a little light.
Red ones.
Red ones, yes. This is Bev. She and I have been sleeping in the same bed for about 40 years, 42, 45. How many is it, Ben?
42.
42.
2 weeks from now.
2 weeks. Okay, you've heard the classic children's joke. Why do firemen wear red suspenders? To keep their pants up. Yes, if you're 6 or 7 years old, that is hilariously funny. Now, not a lot of people ask, why does Ralph wear red suspenders? But when they do, I tell them about an angel named Spiro and a time when I was being not exactly angelic, and how red suspenders brought peace, joy, happiness to my little corner of the world. I have an annoying nerve problem in my leg. When it hurts, which is often, I get cranky and I become a pain in the patouche. I go to the nerve specialist and the bone specialist and the muscle specialist and the general specialist, and they all look very wise and they tell me it's not life-threatening. I know that already. I want them to stop the pain, which isn't severe, but it's persistent, a burr under my saddle, and it gets me feeling pretty grouchy. So I start experimenting to relieve the pain. Baggy pants, I discover, help. But to get them baggy enough, I buy a size too large and have the waist taken in. I take the pants to Spiro, who has a tailor shop above one of the stores downtown. It's full of sewing machines and ironing boards and 1950s pinups of semi-nude women with their navels airbrushed away. This time I go to see Spiro with a pair of blue jeans. Cannot fix blue jeans, says Spiro. He's standing underneath a sign that says, no alterations too difficult. He is a kind and gentle man who understands about my leg and wants to help. Zoing machine needle all go ping, ping, ping on blue jean, he says. Why you not guy go buy some suspenders? Suspenders better for holding pants than belt. Spiro is an angel. At least the part of him that wants to help a man with a hurting leg, that part is angelic. Spiro gives me a pat on the back and sends me off to a store that sells working clothes, and there I buy the first suspenders since high school. In the small town of Horndean, Manitoba, where I grew up, all the men and boys wore suspenders. When I went off to Winnipeg to school, I knew right away that real city guys never wore suspenders, they only wore belts. And nothing was more important to teenage me than being cool. So I bought belts and wore them all those years until I met Spiro. They only have red suspenders in the store, so I buy red suspenders and take them home and clip them to my trousers. Liberation. Freedom. I haven't been this comfortable since I was 12 years old. Thank you, Spiro. You are an angel. Why did I wear belts all those years? Half a century of suffering. Why does any male anywhere, anytime, ever wear a belt? Suspenders are 99.9% more comfortable than belts. You can breathe. You can sit down and your belt buckle doesn't mash your belly button. You can bend over and your buns don't display a plumber's cleavage. As for the pain and the nerve in my leg, well, it still hurts, but only half as much and only sometimes. Spiro was more helpful than all those specialists. Now, I've been a men's liver for years. I even wrote a book called Man to Man. There it is, for the men's movement. So I stand there half naked in front of my closet with a handful of those hateful belts, and I wonder why I and others of my sex wear those gut-binding tourniquets around our middles. Who decrees that men should suffer so for the sake of a waistline? Well, okay, so we do it to ourselves. Now's the time to stop it, men. Do you remember at the height of the feminist movement, the sisters had a bra burning? They decided it was better to be comfortable than to conform to somebody else's idea of sexy. Well, so now it's the men's turn, I figure. I become a born-again belt basher, and I try to organize a rally at which all my liberated male friends will burn their belts in a great bonfire and put on suspenders as a symbol of our newfound freedom. Men of the world, unite! You have nothing to lose but your waistlines. Well, give it a rest, say my friends, and friends of both sexes when I get evangelical about suspenders. So far, I don't have many converts. Well, none, actually. Being a born-again braces believer only manages to get me bemused looks from friends and colleagues who try very hard to say nice things. Except Jake, my grandson. He wears suspenders sometimes, but then a two-year-old doesn't have a whole lot of choice when his granddad is dressing. Make a virtue out of necessity, Ralph, I think. So I assume a superior, long-suffering look, and I buy 6 pairs of red suspenders. Red suspenders become a personal trademark. There are other benefits. Red suspenders are just mildly ridiculous, which gives folks a chance to laugh a little, and that helps sometimes. I got liberated from belts and became a born-again suspender person about the time I got elected to a fairly prestigious position in the church, as close as my denomination, the United Church of Canada, gets to a bishop. Dad, a bishop? Says my son, a bit incredulous. I said, yes, and don't forget that makes you the son of a bishop. My friends, at least some of them, try to avoid me and try to think of something religious to say when I'm around. People often get uptight when clergy, church people, bishops, people like that show up anywhere, and everybody tries to clean up their language, and nobody offers you a drink of anything except tea or lemonade. When I wear red suspenders, it lightens everything up. They realize I am just as rotten, depraved, confessed, confused, ignorant, and generally messed up as they are. I also get to be comfortable. My leg doesn't hurt so much. The host breaks out a bottle of wine. My publisher gets a good title for a book, and everybody is happy. Okay. This evening, I want to do stuff on humor. Now, I'm not going to give you a whole lot of theory on humor, although next week I have a presentation on humor as healing and humor as worship and the various aspects of humor, biblical humor, and all of its great stuff. And I'm going to do that next week if you're around. This time, what I basically want to do is to seduce you a little bit and try and get you to see through example some of the ways in which humor works. So there's a wonderful church tradition of holy foolishness. So for instance, there's the tradition of the Feast of Fools in the church, and there's a tradition that the first Sunday after Easter is Holy Fool's Day. There's all kinds of marvelous stuff, and the Bible is one of the great, funniest books in the world, if you read it right. There's one phrase I would like you to remember. Humor is not the opposite of seriousness. Humor is the opposite of despair. That's a key phrase. Humor is not the opposite of seriousness. Humor is the opposite of despair. That's not my phrase. That comes from Conrad Hyers, who wrote a marvelous book called The Comic Vision and the Christian Faith, which I think was published by Seabury. And then there is the old classic on this. If you graduated from theology about 40 years ago, you would have known that Elton Trueblood was one of the hoary heads of the classic theologians. And he wrote a small book that's now long out of print called The Humor of Christ. And if you are, it's still one of the best books on the whole subject. Among other things, he says, if you listen to the parables of Jesus, and you do not take into consideration the possibility that Jesus may be pulling your leg, you're going to miss the point of several parables. Jesus may be pulling your leg. Anyway, today what I want to do is to simply read you some ways in which humor tends to work. First of all, some biblical humor. You all know the story of Abraham and Sarah and Isaac. Sure you do. And you know that Isaac, what does the word Isaac mean?
Laughter,
yes. Sarah and Jacob are ready for the geriatric war. They're drinking Geritol for breakfast, and suddenly these guys show up and they say, Sarah, you are going to have a baby. And she drops her store teeth laughing so hard back there in the tent. But this is just, a marvelous kind of an event there with this old couple trying to come to terms with the idea that they were going to have a baby. I mean, if that should happen to Bev and me at this point, I don't know what to do, you know? I mean, I couldn't handle it. Grandchildren are fine. You can hand them back to mom and dad when they fill their pants, but children of your own. Here's a poem. At first it was a cough, then a stifled gasp. Sorry, let me try again. At first it was a cough, then a stifled gasp, then a watering of nose and eyes, a rasping, wheezing, rattling noise that might have been a full-blown case of asthma or a stroke. But it was laughter. It was laughter. From arthritic toes to gray and thinning hair, it was laughter from despair to hope, laughter from the tomb to resurrection. The old crone pulled the tent flap tight across her toothless mouth to hide her laughter, hide it from her sniggering, impotent mate, hide the laughter from the bright-eyed strangers who came announcing new and ancient promises, a child of hope for Sarah's ancient arid womb, for Abraham's ancient arid land. But hide it from the future she could not. Sarah birthed a promise in a child named Laughter, and so proclaimed a dancing god into the ages. Yeah. Okay. The tradition of humor in the Bible is wonderful and multi-layered. One of the places where the humor bubbles up most beautifully is in the story of Noah. Sorry, Jonah. Well, Noah too, but Jonah. The story of Jonah and the whale. Now, Jonah and the whale is a parable. We don't know who told the parable, but this always happens. But like the parables of Jesus and the parables of others, Jesus made up stories to illustrate a point. And he was part of a long tradition of storytellers who made up stories to illustrate a point. And the story of Jonah is a wonderful piece of humorous fiction. If you don't believe it's fiction, read the thing carefully. First of all, when Jonah is told to go to Nineveh, he gets on a boat going to Tarshish. Tarshish was the equivalent of Timbuktu. It was the end of nowhere, you know. And then when he finally gets to Nineveh, that great city, 3 days' journey across. A day's journey was about 10 miles. So a city, 3 days' journey across, would be 30 miles across. which was absolutely impossible in terms of the infrastructure of an ancient city. You'd drown in your own garbage. You wouldn't be able to survive in a city that size, nor is there any record at all of a city of that size ever existing anywhere. And, you know, Jonah preaches the shortest sermon on record, and everybody converts, and then he goes out and he sulks. Think of all the agony we could have saved ourselves if we had read that story in that way, a humorous send-up to tell the Jews that the God was not just the God of the Jews, God was also the God of those hateful Ninevites who were beating up on them all the time. That's what the point of the story is. So I would like to read that for you, as I wrote it for children, trying to capture some of that sense of that humor. Jonah was just walking along, minding his business, when God spoke to him. Jonah,
what?
Go to Nineveh and tell the people that unless they stop doing wrong things, I'm going to destroy them. Jonah didn't know what to say, but he knew he didn't want to go to Nineveh, whether God said so or not. So Jonah ran away. I'll run away to Tarshish. That's as far away as I can get. Jonah found a boat that was going to Tarshish. Good, said Jonah. God won't find me here on this boat. So Jonah went down inside the boat and fell asleep. While he was sleeping, a very bad storm came up. The waves were big. The wind was blowing. Help, yelled the sailors. We're going to drown. One of the sailors went down and woke Jonah up. How can you sleep there when there's such an awful storm? We might drown. Jonah saw the big waves and the strong wind. He knew what was happening. It's all my fault, Jonah said to the sailors. I made God angry. The only way you can get the storm to stop is to throw me into the water. We can't do that, said the sailors. You have to, said Jonah, or we'll all drown. So the sailors threw Jonah into the sea, and a great big fish came and swallowed Jonah right up. Bloop. By this time, Jonah knew that when God said, go to Nineveh, God meant go. So, all right, I'll go to Nineveh. Jonah was praying from inside the big fish's belly. Just get me out of this smelly fish. Girl, the big fish vomited Jonah right out onto the beach. Go to Nineveh, God said to Jonah. I'm going, shouted Noah. So Jonah went to Nineveh. He went right to the middle of the city and said, God says to stop doing bad things. If you don't, God will destroy this city. All the people of Nineveh stopped and listened to Jonah. Even the king said, he's right, you know. We have not been living in God's way. Let's try to live the way God wants us to, and maybe God won't destroy us. So God didn't destroy Nineveh. And that made Jonah very angry. I go to all this trouble, and you don't even destroy Nineveh, said Jonah. He just sat down outside of the city. I'm going to just sit here, God, and I might die too, and then you'll be sorry. So Jonah sat down. The sun came out, and it made Jonah feel hot. His stomach felt sick. I think I'm going to throw up. Maybe I'll die here in the hot sun, then God will be sorry. God made a plant come up out of the ground. It grew very quickly. Soon Jonah was sitting in the shade. Oh, that's nice, said Jonah. The sun was really hot. That's a lovely plant. Then, just as quickly, the plant died. A hot wind came up and the sun was hot again. Now Jonah was really angry at God. Why did you kill that plant, God? I needed the shade. What are you trying to do to me? You like that plant? Yes, of course I like that plant. What do you think? So, you like the plant, but you didn't plant it. You didn't help it grow. Don't you think I care about the people of Nineveh? There are many people in Nineveh and lots of animals. I made them the way I made you. Shouldn't I care about them too? So, wonderful. If you want to explore more about the story of Jonah and how and its sense as a piece of humorous fiction, Conrad Hires has written a fine little book on that subject too. I just can't remember the name of it. I have it at home. I should have brought that with me. I'm sorry. But it was also published by Westminster John Knox, and it's a little small book about just a sort of an exegesis of Jonah. Okay. Humor in the Christian context has its greatest function as a means of grace. Notice I say a means of grace. Not the means of grace, but it is one in that great cornucopia of gifts that God has given us. Humor is a means of grace and a way that we can use to help us not only see ourselves more clearly, but understand our faith more deeply. I think that's part of what Paul means when he talks about us being fools for Christ. That sense of foolishness, that bubbling sense of humor that is absolutely essential in order to be a Christian. The phrase, I think, of a humorless Christian to me would be an oxymoron. And I think that this is very much in the spirit of Holden Village, watching the worship, the vespers in the evening, and the Eucharistic service. There is a humor not just bubbling up in the times when you're being intentionally funny, and that's marvelous. Let's keep doing that. But there is a sense of humor in the whole thing. I mean, where else do you see people standing up in their shorts and their hairy legs sticking out and leading in worship? Now, those of you who... I guess I got them, eh? Well, put it this way. I'm not going to ask, but I know a bunch of you are clergy, and the rest of you go to church relatively often, or you probably wouldn't be here. Now, can you think of anything more fundamentally arrogant than a preacher getting up behind a pulpit and pretending to communicate the Word of God? It is the most arrogant act that I can think of. Or to lead in liturgy, to celebrate the Eucharist. Is there anything more arrogant? And yet, at the same time, you are called to do exactly that. Now, you can't hold that kind of tension without a visceral sort of a sense of humor that says, you know, I know this is ridiculous. I know fundamentally I really don't have anything much to say or give, but I do it anyway. And I hope and pray and know that the God will help to communicate through me in spite of my smelly armpits and sneaky feet. Because that is, I have a firm belief that God does have a sense of humor, and that we as Christian people, as Christian leaders, need to have that sense of humor. Now, I have here an article that I published one time way back. It's called How to Preach a Bad Sermon. And I want you to know all these suggestions came from clergy. And the consensus of these people was that there's nothing wrong with a bad sermon provided you do it well. So, here are some suggestions. Be tentative. Be hesitant. Start every assertion with words like, I think perhaps, or I'm not sure, but under no circumstances state anything with conviction. It helps if you mumble. Don't ever use any theatrical skills. They only add life and vitality, and you wouldn't want the sermon to be entertaining now, would you? Use lengthy quotations from the original Aramaic or Greek or Hebrew with lots of condescending translations. That's really good. And be sure the folks know how scholarly you are and how dumb they are by including lots of erudite quotations from biblical scholars they've never heard of. Use the stained glass window voice. You know the sound. You lower your voice and you add a little sort of reverb. Add little tidbits that you assure everyone is going to find hilariously funny and then forget the punchline. Or else mumble it so that nobody can hear it. This is important. Use lots of statistics. Yeah, well, they do it in sports broadcasts all the time. Statistics and more, learn from those people. Keep your eyes on your hand-scribbled text at all times. If you can't do that, speak extemporaneously. With lots of hand-waving and emotion without actually ever saying anything. Never, ever reveal your own humanity or vulnerability. Also, assume that the congregation has heard or read the lections and knows the background of every one of them. This is, last one is most important. Never enjoy your own sermon. If you enjoy it, the congregation might too. Now, it's all fine and dandy to have the theory of preaching a bad sermon. Theories, somebody was saying it's like whapping your head with a stake or something like that. Anyway, it doesn't, you need to have some examples. So I would like to preach you a really bad sermon. First of all, you have to muss your hair and put your glasses down like that, because otherwise people assume if your hair is combed, you don't know anything. You have to have that sort of slept in academic look. Our lesson for today is taken from the directions of a can of Campbell's tomato soup. Pour the contents of this can into a saucepan. Add an equal amount of milk. Stir. Heat just to the boiling point. And serve. Pour the contents. Pour. The first word for our hearts and minds today, pour. The free-flowing liquid cascading in joyous abandon without thought of yesteryear or the morrow, giving of itself without restraint towards its appointed purpose. And so the first words of our text call us to offer ourselves the stewardship of our whole beings, dedicating our whole lives, holding back not a dot nor a tittle. Pour the contents of this can. My friends, will you note the glorious specificity of this call? Our call is not to pour the contents of any old can. There's nothing wishy-washy or mamby-pamby about this call. This call comes directly to us, beckoning, yea, imploring us to pour the contents of this can. This very can, no other can will do. And into what do you pour the contents of this can? Into a saucepan. That word, rich in meaning and metaphor, is made up of two root words, sauce and pan. Sauce. There is a certain joy de vivre in that word, implying, as it does, the juiciness of life, if one may be so bold. There is justice, equality of gender implied as well, because after all, what is sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander. And pan, think if you will of the rich residue of language based on that one little word, panorama, pantomime, pantheism, pantyhose. Add add an equal amount. We add. We do not subtract. We add. It is through the power of positive thinking, through participatory democracy, collegial decision making, through consensus, through joining the forces in unity of purpose and solidarity with everyone everywhere, that we shall overcome the forces of darkness and destruction and degradation that threaten to overwhelm us. Ah, but positive action becomes imperialism when carried to excess. And so it behooves us to take care that we add an equal amount. If we add too little, our stewardship will be in question. If we add too much, we shall destroy the very thing we have come to which to the aid of have. And to what do we add an equal portion? Of milk. Of milk. Milk, the first food of our infancy, the final food of our flaming ulcers. Milk, in our concern for the environment, it is worthy of note that milk is a natural, sugar-free, salt-free, biodegradable food, which in its original form at least comes in a reusable container. And then the shortest sentence of our text. One single word, but what a word it is, my friends, what a word. Stir. Stir in the passionless poison that pollutes our population, in the lampant laxity that lubricates our land, in the meaningless mediocrity that modifies our mission. We must heed this call to involvement. We can no longer stand and stare silently on the sidelines of society. We must participate passionately in picking from the parade of paltry, puny paradigms those points that promote our particular program. Heat just to the boiling point. Ah, my friends, there is the temptation, is it not? How many of us slide slowly into the slime of sinfulness, seduced into somnolence, yea, thinking, yes, I will not succumb, ha ha. But we teeter on the tip of temptation. We slip on the slow, slimy slide into sensuousness before we careen into the caustic cauldron of concupiscence. Beware, therefore, that you heat just to the boiling point. And with that ringing in our ears, our text moves to the final point, our final ringing call to action. Hear these words and serve. Serve. That is our mission. That is our call to involvement. This is our call to go into all the world and serve tomato soup in the name of the president, the vice president, and the general secretary. Amen. My own writing here. Oh yeah, I know what I was saying. On various occasions, I have a sort of a sermon in the barrel that I trot out from time to time on humor, which I preach on various occasions, and I'm not doing that very much anymore because almost inevitably, at the end of the service, you know how people make comments as they come out the door. Somebody says, I agree, we should laugh all our troubles away. And that is manifestly not what I am advocating. I am saying that humor is one of the gifts, but laughter is not the appropriate response or the useful response to all of life's pains. There are many times when tears are appropriate, or anger, or despair. Humor is one way of dealing, especially with the locale problems. But also, but also some of the deeper problems. Humor has a wonderful way of letting the steam off. Many of you who are clergy have gone to families when someone has died, and you have sat there to listen to their pain and listen to talk about the father or mother or whoever it was that has died. And then somebody, there's great sadness, and then somebody says something that under other circumstances might not be a bit funny, and everybody laughs and it sort of loosens the tension. You've had that experience, I'm sure. This is one of the ways in which humor can have a useful effect within those kinds of things. There is a patron saint of humor, and I wrote a little article about him, and I want to read it to you. This is especially for preachers, or anybody who makes speeches for that matter. I would like to nominate the Reverend Dr. William Archibald Spooner, born in 1844, died in 1930, as the patron saint of preachers. There is probably already such a patron saint, but Spooner, I think, is more eminently qualified than any other person could possibly be. Consider. Spooner did a reasonably creditable job. He worked hard, paid his dues, did all the things he should have done. Julian Huxley, the brother of Aldous, described him as a good scholar and a good teacher who had, quote, that rare quality which I can only describe as saintliness. And yet, Spooner is most remembered for a few occasions when he tripped over his own words, when he got his tang all tumbled. He gave a name to that transpositional gaffe that offered delight to hearers but despair to the utterers, Spoonerisms. You show me a speaker who has given more than a talk or two, and I'll show you a person who's had at least a mild case of Spooner's moot and fout disease. Spooner was not the first nor the last to suffer from that affliction, nor was his case much worse than that infecting many speakers. But the stories began, and the legend took off, and soon it outstripped reality. Spooner really admitted to only one Spoonerism, announcing the hymn, "Conquering Kings Their Titles Take." He apparently said, "Kinkering Kongs." And the legend might have been contained, except that Spooner taught at New College in Oxford, and the Reverend Doctor's occasional clerical errors got the stories going, and soon the campus comedians were inventing Spoonerisms. Here are a few of the gaffes attributed to the poor, unfortunate Dr. Spooner. Blushing crow for a crushing blow. At a wedding, he is presumed to have said, "It is customary to cuss the bride." In his sermons, Spooner is said to have referred to tearful chidings when he meant cheerful tidings. And the hymn, "From Greenland's Icy Mountains," was transformed to "From Iceland's Greasy Mountains." The prodigal son was on the busy drink of destruction, and he assured his congregation that the Lord is a shoving leopard. The evening, Spooner is said to have sighed, "It is beery work preaching to empty wenches." Spooner could have used a more developed sense of humor to protect himself from the students of Oxford if he'd had the grace to be amused at the real gaffes as well as at the legend. Life would have been much easier for him. As it was, he railed and fumed at the stories developing around him, which of course fed the fiction. Spooner lacked the grace to laugh at himself, and it cost him dearly. He left a great gift that he didn't intend and mostly hated. By giving his name to this common linguistic malady, Spooner helped us become aware that we all suffer from it occasionally or often, and that its only antidote is laughter. When Spoonerisms were named, the language experts began describing and cataloging them so that folks like me could occasionally use them to good effect and add a bit of spice to an otherwise dull and unconvincing narrative. Of course, the best Spoonerisms come as a surprise to the speaker. Reading a commercial on radio for some long-forgotten medication, I once said, "Do you sometimes feel dill and lustless?" On another occasion, I transposed rug and drape shop to, you guessed it, drug and rape shop. And in an inspiring speech at a graduation ceremony, I invited the students at one point to wound our heels, and a little later to fail into the suture. It was not one of my best speeches. So, let us name the good Dr. Spooner the patron saint of preachers and celebrate his birthday, July 22nd, with a 21 Sun Galoot. Let's mark the day with spoons full of speecherisms, beginning perhaps with the granddaddy of them all, committed, and this is true, committed by an announcer for the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation following the broadcast of a church service. Next week, the sermon will be titled, "Cast Thy Broad Upon the Waters." This is the Canadian Bread Corping Cast Race. All of you are in congregations, or in one way or another, I think, or at least most of you. And so you have to work with interpersonal interrelationships. You know, you all know that churches would function so well if we didn't have people in them. It's the weird interactions and mixtures of people. And Bev and I took a gaggle of tourists around Europe to see the Ober-Ammergau Passion Play. How long ago was that, Bev? About 15 years ago?
The extra one in the 80s.
In the extra 80s, yeah. And it that busload, this was a tour led by Christian Tourism Travel, so all the participants had at least some church connection. And it became a little sort of a mini congregation, sort of in a cocoon, and lots of things happened there in microcosm that often happen in congregations, which led to this article called Toilet Training Tourists.
Who told you I could stay home?
I told you you'd already heard all this. Anyway, what travel agents never tell you is that North American tourists going to Europe need to be housebroken. Mostly that involves learning one critical life skill: to laugh at yourself. Without that, the Belgians can reduce you to a bowl of emotional jelly in a week. The Italians can do it in a day. European culture has great variety: fine wines, great music, and incomprehensible toilets. American civilization has only two kinds of wine, red and white, and two kinds of music, country and old-time fiddlers. There isn't much variety in toilets either. Europeans want the necessities of life to be interesting. North Americans want them to be functional. Europeans, in charge of getting stuff in and out of human bodies, are mad, slightly drunk artists from the left bank of the Seine. North Americans, in charge of the ingress and egress of food and drink, are nerdy types with computers. Now, the travel agents know about all this, but they keep it a secret, and they recruit unsuspecting folks with leadership qualities to be tour group leaders. Someone has to guide these naive North Americans who want their food pronounceable and their toilets flushable into a world where food must have elan and the toilets must offer a challenge. Successful tour group leaders combine the skills of a sheepdog, den mother, and priest, but above all, a mentor in the fine art of life. Tour group leaders must keep the group laughing, preferably at themselves. Bev and I led a gaggle of 39 tourists around Europe in one of those, if this is Tuesday, it must be Belgium, kind of junkets. Now, led is an overstatement. Bev walked at the head of the pack, throwing body blocks and temper tantrums, tripping, doing whatever was necessary to slow them down. I ran back and forth across the back of the herd like a Scottish sheepdog, nipping at heels, barking at the laggards, and generally making myself the most unpopular person in the whole group. The food was not too much of a problem because tour buses only stop at places where the waiters have North American sight, and they give them a steak sandwich and coffee or a hamburger and Coke, regardless of what they may order. As long as we could keep them away from small restaurants up dark alleys where the waiters have black mustaches and dirty aprons, our 39 tourists did just fine on food. But the toilets. Europeans regard toilets as an art form, not a utility. Theater art primarily, because what could be better comedy than North Americans trying to cope with European plumbing, huh? Until we got the point of it all, we found ourselves the butt of the joke. Toilet training... Toilet training tourists is a matter of attitude, not technology. One of the funniest scenes is watching a tourist try to get into a European toilet. You need a coin. So you stand in line for 45 minutes to churn from dollars into whatever. Then as you desperately fumble to find the right coin to put in the slot, you discover you have every other coin except the specific one required. So you give up and quietly wet your pants. It was the women on our tour bus who worked out a strategy. Whenever the bus stopped in a new country, which seemed to be every hour or so, they would charge en masse to the biffy and line up, having sent a delegate, preferably a young husband with a good bladder, to the place where they change money and instructions. Get one sample of every coin minted in the past 50 years. One of those coins would fit the slot. Once one woman got into the cubicle, she would hold the door open for the next and so on, and into the effect that the whole bunch could go doo-doo on one dime. Now, was that ripping off the folks who owned the bathrooms? Probably. But in a contest between distended bladders and ethics, bladders were never done. And the women learned to do it with such triumphant whoops and so much laughter, even the Germans offered a grudging admiration. The more progressive countries posted guards in each bathroom, to which you paid your florins or francs or razbucniks. All the guards in the women's bathrooms were men, and vice versa. Speculation on the bus had it that since the job didn't pay much, there needed to be fringe benefits. If the main reason for European toilets is to entertain Europeans, then what better way to do it than with a bit of good-natured voyeurism? We almost lost one of our men, a retired hypertensive banker, to this system. It was in Italy where the toilets presented even more of a challenge than in France, if that's possible. He came staggering back to the bus, his face beet red, hyperventilating, not seeing anything even slightly funny about anything. That's supposed to be the men's can, right? I go in there, this big fat babe is there right in front of the men's John, and she wants, I don't know, 10,000 lira or something. I give her all my money, and she gives me four little tiny bits of brown paper, and then she stands right outside the cubicle, right outside it, and I couldn't do a damn thing. Half an hour later, after we brought him down from the edge of an aneurysm, I visited the same facility. The staff, all women, were still laughing. Bev and I also enjoyed an exciting toilet adventure in a busy piazza in Rome. Asking the question that most tourists ask most often, she was directed to a stainless steel bunker right in the center of a traffic circle around the small park. It didn't seem to have a door. But it had coin slots and a sign which asked in four languages for 8 million lira. That's about 25 cents. She dropped in the money and voila! A stainless steel door slid open silently and revealed the sparkling, clean facilities within. The call of nature being stronger than her sense of foreboding, Bev went in. Silently, the door slid shut. I stood outside and wondered if I would ever see my friend. Inside, inside, Bev discovered that once the call of nature had been answered, her anxiety took over. There was no handle on the door, no button to press, no lever to pull. There was no window to wave out of, no phone to call on, no sign in any language which indicated what to do once you were done. There was only one tiny lever. It said, flush, in seven languages. Since she couldn't think of anything else to do, she flushed. Silently, the door slid open. Sobbing our joy and relief, we rushed into each other's arms. As we walked away, we saw a bench on which were perched four elderly gentlemen. It was situated exactly where they would get the best view when the door slid open. All the other benches in the piazza were empty. You know, said Bev, I usually flush before I do myself up. That must be the best show in town. And then, give her credit, she managed to laugh, and so did I. And the old men were laughing too, this time with us rather than at us. The toilets had done their job for the Italian men and this Canadian couple. All of us learned a little of the art of life. Who says Europeans only tolerate North Americans because of their money? Anyway.
Haven't hit Chinese toilets yet, have you?
No, well, yes, I have. Bev and I lived in the Philippines and were in the Philippines as missionaries for 5 years.
Yeah.
And their toilets often are like that. Yes, you learn.
You learn.
You have no choice but to learn. If you don't learn, you're on the next plane home after about 3 or 6 months. We had a couple of couples who just simply couldn't adapt, and they had to go home, because if you don't, you learn like about things like bed bugs and cockroaches. Do you know that Bev there is the fastest straw in the East? She's a city girl, but when she would be sitting there. And I don't think she'd ever seen a cockroach before we got to the Philippines, had you, Bev?
No.
No, okay. But she got so good. In the Philippines, of course, you wear slippers, which they call bakya, which is just a sole and a strap over the top there. And she'd be sitting there reading. And she could, without taking her eyes from the book, grab that bakya, whack a cockroach, never miss, perfect day, every time. One last thing, and then any things that you want to argue with or talk about. My longtime friend, Glenn Baker, held an important church office for a while, and this got him traveling all over. Once, while visiting a small congregation in northern British Columbia, he was invited to dedicate the new indoor bathroom that the congregation had just installed. He agreed to do it following the main part of the program. But while that was going on, Glenn recalls, a toddler wandered through the bathroom door and was standing open right behind the speaker, and in full view of everyone, baptized the facilities in the most appropriate manner. Glenn, I said, is there an appropriate prayer to bless a bathroom? Well, Glenn said, that's worth thinking about. Exactly. And there should be. With the exception of the bedroom, there is no other room in the house that is more in need of blessing. It is in the bathroom, after all, that most of us see the reality of who we are. We stand there, naked before the mirror and before God, with our pretensions lying in a soggy heap like our soiled and saggy clothes on the floor. Before we join the folks in the living room, we can tighten the belt one notch, hitch up the bra another inch, powder the zit on the nose, comb the hair over the bald spot, or check our lipstick. But first, we have to confront the reality that what we see in the mirror is us. And for me, what I see is no great aesthetic joy. A Greek god I am not. It is in the bathroom that we deal with the most basic necessities of life and with all the sounds and smells that go with it. It is in the bathroom that we kneel, face over toilet, head pounding and stomach heaving, and repent for the sins of the night before. In the movie Oh God, the first appearance of God to John Denver is in the bathroom. Don't worry, you needn't be ashamed, says George Burns, playing the part of God. I know what you got. If God is everywhere, God is in the bathroom, an important theological concept. A spiritual life worth having is not just for special times. If it's only there for us when we're walking through the sun-drenched mountains with Julie Andrews singing The Hills Are Alive, it's not worth having. It's got to be there for the rotten times too, when you've lost your job or your partner or your self-respect, or the doctor has just said you have breast or prostate cancer, or when you are just plain depressed or bored. Spirituality needs to be there for the grunge times, the ordinary times, the day-by-day stuff. Getting the kids off to school, or fixing the leak under the sink, or realizing for the 400th time that Mr. or Miss Wonderful has zits on his or her buttocks. God has got to be there in our bathroom with us, knowing everything we've got or not got. Our spirituality has to be there when we see ourselves naked in the mirror, morning after morning, before we have time to clean ourselves up, before we can tuck in our tummies and brush away our dragon mouth. Just as I am without one plea, as the old hymn goes. There should be a special blessing for bathrooms. I learned about bathroom blessings the day I wandered the halls of an office building in Lower Manhattan. I was there for a meeting, but the room was full of smoke and I could feel myself getting a migraine headache. It was a big meeting. They would miss me if I snuck out for a while, because I knew that fresh air or sleep is the only possible cure for that kind of an emerging migraine. I looked outside the window and realized that fresh air in Lower Manhattan was as scarce as welfare mums on a cruise ship. So I headed for the men's bath, sat down in one of the cubicles, and used a technique I developed during years of singing in church choirs, where you learn how to sleep sitting up and with your eyes open if necessary. I had my snooze and got rid of my headache, but later on, over coffee during a break in the meeting, I was exchanging small talk with another man. You know, he said, I went into the can a few minutes ago and there was a guy in the cubicle next to me. He was snoring. He looked at me strangely when I laughed a little harder than he thought necessary. I never told him it was I who had been snoring. I was just thankful that even public buildings have private little chapels where millions of people have gone when there is nowhere else to be alone with your pain. Sometimes the old biff is the only place you can go to wait for the spirit to give you whatever you need to carry on. On a cold winter day, I drove 2 hours in a rented car to make a speech. It was a big speech, an important speech. I arrived about 20 minutes before I was to stand up and do my thing. As usual, I went to place my text on the podium. It was not in my briefcase. I searched frantically everywhere, everything, the car, my pockets, my briefcase for the 10th time, but no speech. I felt sick enough to throw up. 5 minutes to showtime and I had nothing to say, nothing. I retreated to a nearby bathroom, locked the door, and wept. Then I prayed. Then I tried to make an outline on a paper towel. Except I couldn't read my normally terrible scrawl made worse by soft paper and written on my lap. All right, God, this is it. This speech is going to happen on pure adrenaline or faith or both. 5 minutes into it, I realized I can do this. I've got the main points of this diatribe in my noggin. 10 minutes in, I began to relax a little. 20 minutes in, I was having a good time, seeing the response and faces, making the eye contact, responding to the puzzled looks, enjoying the smiles and the laughter. 30 minutes and I wound up with a flourish and I got a standing O. I headed back to my chapel in the washroom, where I alternately cried and laughed, and the tears and the laughter were my prayer of thanks. Yes, Glenn, bathrooms need a very special blessing. Reactions, responses. responses, thoughts, arguments?
Well, you talk about humor, and some of the things that you mentioned in your articles there were the sudden change in direction.
Uh-huh.
And such as a blessing for a blessing for a bathroom. Right away, it's funny.
Yeah.
And do you comment any more on that, or how you can use them in your speeches, or is it worth it? And several in the Bible I can think of, about the coins and the fish paying for the tax.
Well, the essence of most humor is sort of turnabout. It's the authors call it the rule of three, where you you establish something with one person doing something. Then you have another person doing the same thing, so you have a pattern. And then you have a third person who breaks the pattern. In humor, it usually means sort of turning it upside down. If you come to my speech on humor on next week, I will talk about the archetype of the youngest son, who may be male or female, but this is how they describe it. The youngest child, the one least expected. And this is the humorous archetype that happens over and over and over again in the Bible. And I won't give you any examples this time. But a humor is essentially a setup. You lead people a little way and they think they're going here and you've got them over there. It's surprise. That's the essential aspect of humor. But one of the things I will be also saying and elaborating on is what I believe very firmly, that a sense of humor has nothing to do with the ability to tell jokes. The ability to tell jokes is a theatrical and writing skill that can be learned and developed. But a sense of humor is different. A couple of months ago, I had a marvelous experience, a beautiful experience, of being at the bedside of one of my very close friends, Bob Hatfield, as he was dying. Now, Bob had been a medical doctor, and he had been also a marvelous church person all his years. In fact, many years ago, he received a DD from one of our theological colleges, an honorary degree. And he mentioned at that point that it's an honorary degree is like a tail on a pig. It doesn't actually do anything, but adds a little class to the ham. He already had an MD. And just as he was retiring, the University of Calgary, one of the big universities, gave him an LLD. So he said, well, now I've got MD, DD, LLD, that means Mersey Dotes and Dosey Dotes, middle Lamsey Dye. Now that was clever. But as I was at his bedside, and it was wonderful because first time in my life I've ever managed to say goodbye to a person the way you should do it, without any playing of games or this sort of thing. There were tears and there were anger and all the emotions and laughter, and it was genuine. But this, on their mantelpiece, was a picture of Bob when the University of Calgary had given him his LLD. And he had on his Snoopy tie. Now, you see, this was, the people out there didn't know it. Mostly nobody noticed it, but he did this for himself because it was his way of maintaining perspective and knowing that you know, that this was, you know, when it all comes down to it, this is a nice thing to have happen, and he was very glad, but remember that Bob is still Bob, and he was a small-town kid who managed to do a few things. That was the kind of thing. That the sense of humor is a more of an attitude towards life than it is a way of being. My grandmother She never told a joke in her life, and I don't think ever got the point of one. But when I would come in, when we visited, she always seemed to have her hands in flour, making things. She would come over and dust my nose with flour. And then sometimes she would go and dust my dad's nose with flour. And Dad was born in a three-piece suit, you see. And that would first of all make him mad, and then he would relax a little bit and laugh about it. But it wasn't particularly clever. But she was just that kind of a person for whom life was a joy, and she said, saw the fun and the joy of all that was going on. Not that she laughed at everything, she cried too. But she did know how to laugh. And that's what I mean by a sense of humor, which is not some very practiced comedians. I'm sure have a really, really don't have a sense of humor. Like I've never liked Don Rickles. His humor always seems to be a knife turning in somewhere. Bill Cosby's humor tends to be inclusive. Everybody gets to laugh. You know, so I shouldn't be doing this. I'm shooting my wad in terms of. How many of you will be here next week?
Nobody.
We gotta stop. I'll just say one more thing. There are two kinds of jokes in the world. There are dirty jokes and there are funny jokes. Dirty jokes are jokes that have victims. And you can find all sorts of racial and gender jokes and those kinds of things where somebody is put down. It is not just that dirty jokes have to do with sex. There are lots of clean jokes that have to do with sex. What is wrong with jokes that are dirty are those where somebody is the butt of the joke. Somebody isn't laughing. And that I think we need to pay very particular attention to in our humor. Is there a victim in this joke? If it is, throw it out. Don't use it at all under any circumstances ever. But if it is a joke in which everybody is laughing, then it's a clean joke. Now, some of those jokes may be appropriate in one occasion and not in another, but nevertheless, it's a clean joke if everybody there is laughing and not laughing at somebody out there. A joke that you make in a community where you know each other and you are laughing at yourselves, that kind of humor is holy and healthy. But the kind of humor where somebody externally or somebody in the group is the victim is a dirty joke. Don't use them. Okay, that's enough.